So, questions?
Based on the conversation you're having here, and along with that, I understand there's a bill floating around in the legislature that would make it harder for the governor to sustain a veto in regard to budgetary items. So I'm wondering why there'd be a motivation to make it more difficult for the governor to veto when we really, I think it's a good thing that there's pressure to keep the budget under control. But yet, if the legislature agrees and they get enough people to do it, then they can still override the governor. Why limit the governor's ability to successfully veto?
So it's, as they say in Juneau, it's a policy call. Alaska is the only state in the entire country that has a threshold as high as having a three-quarters vote, which in Juneau it's 45 out of the 60, in order to override any decision that the governor might make with his veto pen. This past session, and as early as, I don't know, about 3 weeks ago or so, when we had a joint session, you had a situation where the majority of legislators basically exercised their appropriation powers and made decisions that they thought were appropriate for the needs of their constituents. And then the governor, working with a smaller group of legislators, governor came in and made quite significant vetoes, and then was able to sort of uphold those vetoes with the help of a small group of legislators who, depending on who you talk to, is perfectly appropriate because it's certainly authorized under the structure that we have in place now. Or if you talk to somebody else, the majority of those other legislators who made those decisions in the first place should be the ones that have the appropriation powers. But this issue of taking that three-quarter vote threshold and reducing it down to two-thirds, I believe, is the bill in Juneau. So it'd be 45 of 60 down to 40. I'm not sure that that's going to pass this year. I think it's got an uphill battle to be. But I think it's a discussion that a lot of led forward in the sense that, we made what we thought were very deliberative decisions about the budget. And then, not just this governor, but future governors down the road, with working with a smaller group of legislators, can essentially control the entire process over the objections of the majority of the legislature. And we're all familiar with separate branches of government, the separation of powers doctrine, and the legislature being to have its own authorities to appropriate. So, that question, I think, is going to be, under consideration in Juneau. I don't expect the bill to pass. I'm glad you brought it up.
I'd also note that the House hasn't seen that bill. I haven't seen that bill. It's still on the Senate side, so it's got a long way to travel, and we have not seen it. But before we move on from here, I want to direct your attention to the pie, the orange slice of the pie. You see the earnings reserve, $11 billion. Last year, that was about $18, $19 billion, and we tried to put $9 billion of that into the blue section of that pie that is constitutionally protected, so it couldn't be touched. It would be in for long-term investments. And we did that, and the governor, I think, vetoed about $5 billion. We were able to put $4 billion in, and then we did some inflation proofing, so it was a pretty good year overall. But so going back to the orange slice of the pie, the earnings reserve account, that is the section of the pie that absorbs all the market fluctuations in the permanent fund investment pool. So the chart that I asked you to remember in 2008, when it took that 20% dive, and a couple of years before that it took a 6% dive, a 20% dive today on the value of that permanent fund dividend is about $12 billion. And all that would impact that orange slice of the pie. So it's important there that that earnings reserve account not be drained, because you need it, because you can't touch that blue portion. And all that you see in that slice is not all realized gains. There's a lot of unrealized gains in that slice of the pie. So just wanted to bring that to your attention. And Neil's here to keep me honest, because he knows that. So.
And again, we'd be more than happy to go back on this slide or any other slide if you want to go back to with any future questions. So, interesting slide here, because on the left you have the permanent fund in its sort of current state of about 67 and growing $1 billion. The permanent fund trustees itself have set an objective in about 10 years to grow the fund to $85 billion. But an important component of growing that fund is to stay within the means of what we can take from it every year, which is a 5% average, as I was pointing out to you earlier, and splitting that off between what we spend it on. And I think the majority will of the legislature at this point is to continue, of course, providing core services and some kind of a reasonable permanent fund dividend in a manner that allows us to grow the fund down the road. And if you ask me personally, I'm very supportive of doing this, because I want this permanent fund to get big enough to where we can have, you know, essentially the will to be able to provide all the services we need, provide as big as permanent fund dividend as possible, and keep Alaska a low tax environment, keep Alaska an economy that's you know, built around resource development, an economy that's healthy and has the ability to fund all the core services that we need to keep you know, everyday life functioning in the state. And I expect the legislature, which by the way doesn't have a particular policy or a vision in law, you know, in terms of growing the fund over time, to consider that question more seriously as time goes on. Because, you know, we've been trying to make the point repeatedly here that we're now relying on, you know, a big chunk of revenue from the fund itself to pay for core services. So we're getting down to the last two or three slides. We're getting into some pretty busy slides here. Dale, to your point earlier, you asked about the averaging amount of a budget and so forth, and let's take a little deeper dive into that and maybe have Neil give some more detail here in a moment. But if we look at these slides, a couple of big takeaway is you kind of get to see what we spend state government on and where the money comes from. And this is, you know, the current budget. And you can see a big chunk of the revenue stream comes from earnings from the permanent fund, a smaller chunk from oil revenue, and then that other category sort of somewhere down on the bottom. A few years ago, oil revenue would have been basically up to the top. We didn't start using this until FY18, just a short couple of years ago. And if you go over here and look at what we spend it on, education, health and social services are the two biggest categories, about half of it. And, you know, you might recall that a moment ago I mentioned constitutional responsibilities, things that we have to essentially fund in order to put our budget together. These two components right here are about half of it. Then you get into a whole bunch of other smaller components, Department of Corrections, the university, public safety, fish and game, and a whole bunch of other elements. And I don't think it's been lost in any of you that both of these towers right here show a $3,000 PFD and the budget deficit that would be accompanying it. And I think this is an important graph to maybe spend some time on. And Gary, I think you're about ready to pull the mic out of my hand here, but let me finish a second. So the $3,000 PFD, and this is essentially what the governor is proposing. You know, look how big it is in comparison to all the other things that we have to budget. It's a large chunk, as they would say, and it provides us with a deficit that, like we talked a moment ago, we got three ways to fill this gap right here. You cut out of here significantly, you come up with new revenues, or you overdraw the earnings from the permanent fund or the CBR. That's the intersection that we're at in Juneau. That's the heart of the tough choices. That's been the heart of going into special session the last 4 or 5 years that we've undergone. I think at that point, Gary, let me turn things over to you.
No, I can't say much to this slide. But what I can say, we've showed you the pictures and charts about revenue, where it come from, where it's going, the size of our blocks and the size of the earnings and where the earnings are coming from. But we didn't put many numbers with it, and I think it's important to note a couple things, because some people are just number people, as I am one of them. Sometimes I really struggle with this picture here. But the state brings in about $5.2 billion in revenue. About 66% of that is interest earnings from the permanent fund. About 26% of that is earnings from taxes, royalties on oil and gas industry, and then there's some miscellaneous earnings. So more than two-thirds of our revenue now comes in the last 4 years from interest earnings, not oil and tax revenue. So when we talk about numbers, I'm going to ask Neil to explain this in a little bit. But, you know, a $3,000, so in that sense, when I say we're bringing in $5.2 billion, our expenses for, I'm going to say the bottom four, excluding the permanent fund down there, we're spending about $4.6 billion. So we really have a $600 to $700 million surplus if you take PFP equation, you know. So we're not broke, but a $3,000 PFD. I'm going to ask Neil for the numbers on that, and then I'm going to ask him what it is for a $1,600 dividend. But you can see it is the dividend that makes our deficit. So, you know, really the question for you guys is, how do we pay for it? How big a dividend? Do you want us to continue to rob from savings / services for a bigger dividend, or just pay out the one that we can afford? And that's the debate we're having. And Neil, do you have them numbers by any chance? You can.
So the cost of the PFD that we paid out last year was a little over $1 billion, just over $1 billion. And what's being proposed now, so that was for the 1600, so $3,100 PFD would then cost about a little over $2 billion. And I've got a point on that. Maybe I'll come back to it, but those are the numbers.
Thanks, Neil. So as we're moving forward, there's probably nothing more important for us to do than the good, sound fiscal policy, and that's what we're striving to do. And we're getting closer to that every single day. But we wanted to make you guys aware of the challenges we're having and the struggles with that. Can you go back one slide for me, Bryce? There was something I wanted to, maybe one more. Nope, go forward one time there. So this one here is this is a plan to get to $85 billion by 2030, which is, 9 years away. My preference would be to see $100 billion in 5 more years after that. When I talked to Angela Rodell, the executive director of Permanent Fund Corp., I said, can we get to $100 billion in 30 years? She said, with a lot of fiscal discipline, yes, you could, you know. And then you could draw 4%, 4.5%, 5%. We wouldn't be having these conversations. Everybody advocates for some new revenue measures, and we talk about them all the time. But in the studies I've seen, or I've heard about, or the studies we've discussed, it doesn't appear that any revenue measure in itself is going to generate enough revenue to make a substantial difference. To make a substantial difference, you'd have to implement a statewide sales tax, a statewide income tax, change entire corporate tax structure, and about anything else you could see. Many of you aren't aware that only a third of our entire population is gainfully employed, one third. And they're not all the big high-paying jobs that people would like to think they are. And so that is the challenge of the revenue measures. I think we'll someday get there. We'll keep getting creative. There's a couple small revenue measures that you may see move this year. The head tax proposed out of the Senate, and then a doubling of the motor fuel tax. Won't raise much money, but it does help for DOT and for education, them two revenue measures there. So any thoughts on that, Bryce?
Yeah, a couple questions. George?
Yeah, I got a question. How much money is put in the budget for the oil tax incentives?
This year, the governor just came out with his amendments a few days ago, and he put in $55 million to pay this year. The total outstanding for the tax credits, I believe it was about $700 million.
Don't you think you should work on them tax credits?
Right, and they are in there. So that would pay. So there's a right now what's happening is you can either pay the full amount, which is there's a statutory minimum, and if right now this whole bond program is in court right now to pay down those tax credits, if the courts support the bond program, then the number that the governor put in for the $55 million will go through, and it'll probably go through on the House and I suspect on the Senate. If the courts strike down the program, then that number will go up to $166 million, and so that will be a good chunk of the $700 million that's outstanding.
And I think maybe to add to what Neil was saying, the tax credit program has largely been discontinued. And so those numbers that Neil was talking about that might be in the budget this year and the overall amount of $700 million are what we owe from the past. So, but we're having to pay off those obligations, and there's a program that we can talk more in detail about if you want, a bonded debt program that we're trying to work with oil companies to settle that commitment from years past. But that's a whole different topic. Vince?
In SB 21, there's, isn't it an $8?
Isn't there an $8 per barrel credit, right, is what they have right now? And I heard there's talk about cutting that in half to $4 or $5. If you cut it in half, the $4 per, or made it $4 per barrel, how much would we save, or how much smaller would the deficit be? Do you have any estimate?
Yeah, so that per barrel tax credit applies to some oil fields, and to some oil fields it doesn't. And the rough numbers, ballparking it, would be, I've heard about 300, maybe 400 million on the top end if we were to take that $8 amount per barrel tax credit and sort of cut it in half. We've not analyzed that through the committee process yet. That may come about because I think and I hope, again, back to the theme that you're looking through our eyes as legislators, there's a real struggle down there to find a balance between funding core services and also funding a PFD that's Alaskans going to allow us to leave Dodge with. And so, you know, I expect that the conversation about the per barrel tax credit to probably get more consideration as we go forward, get into the second part of the session. But heretofore, we really just haven't dug into it. I kind of wanted to make one additional point here. We'll go back to you, Dale, in a moment. The order of these, it's not chronological. We just stacked them up in whatever order. You know, for some people, the permanent fund dividend may be on the very top, if you will, in terms of, or the very first thing that gets paid. Schools, Medicaid, everything may be secondary to that. I see a nodding of a head there in the front row. I think there's agreement with that, but to a lot of other, they would probably support funding a responsible budget, and again, as we keep saying, like a broken record here, some kind of a responsible permanent fund dividend. Dale?
Why does the state want to be in charge of a college, a ferry system, and a railroad? Why can't you privatize some of that stuff? That way you don't even have those employees to have to put insurance, retirement, and things like that. And if you privatize it, then you can open it up to the private market. And then you can get taxes from that.
Well, I'll give you my best response and then hand the mic over. You know, it's interesting. Back when our Constitution was put into place back in 1955 and 56, which of course predated statehood in 58, 59, you know, we had the luxury of looking at, since we were the 49th state, you know, it'd become a state, and Hawaii was number 50. We had the luxury of being able to look at other states and their constitutions and the way they did things. And the one thing our framers, when they met up there in that cold winter of 55, 56 in Fairbanks, didn't want is they didn't want to have counties. They didn't want layers and layers of utility taxes, school taxes, local taxes. So they essentially put a framework together where the state provided more services than a typical state did, because they didn't want to have a structure that they thought didn't work so well in other states. And along the way, you know, the ferries came about in 1959, 1960. The state actually went into debt to build those ferries, which were still same ferries that we're trying to keep in the service 56 years later. And a university system that even goes back further into territorial days that the framers felt was important and that the state should play a big role in terms of funding. But here we are in 2020 at a point where we've got tough choices to make because we've got services that people say we should pay. We've also got a permafund dividend that people say we should pay. And so I think, to your point specifically, we are looking at restructuring the ferry system. The university has endured pretty significant budget cuts with probably more to come. So I think to the point that you make, we are going in that direction to where these two entities are sort of carrying more of their freight, if you will, to put it very broadly.
What about the railroad? Why do we get
so? Well, the railroad is pretty self-sufficient, and it has its own assets, and so it's in pretty good shape. The ferries would never, you couldn't privatize them and have them service the communities that need to be serviced in this state. It's just that simple. We're looking at a public-private partnership. I don't know how far that will go, but there are communities that it simply would not be profitable for a private company to service those areas. And after all, it's a marine highway, and so Alaskans that live in rural Alaska, coastal Alaska, deserve their highway every bit as much as anybody else does, from a lot of people's perspective, including my own.
So, it absolutely is a marine highway. It's and the discomfort is everybody thinks they're spending too much money on the marine highway system. We are spending state dollars to fund the marine highway system, but you never hear anybody complain about the $1 billion a year we take in from the federal government to maintain our paved highways. You know, every one of them are subsidized. We're not paying that bill. So if you lived in Southeast, you wouldn't even ask the question, why would we have to have ferries? But we have 3,400 miles of coastal properties to service and hundreds of communities, you know. Two-thirds of the communities in this state are not accessible by road. We got a very limited road system. That's a big part of our entire infrastructure. You know, the railroad was given to us from the federal government. It's pretty self-sufficient, but it struggles. It absolutely does struggle. There's some proposals out there for them to get rid of some of their properties and boost their bottom line. And there's a study being done about tying it to the Canadian rail system. There's a province over there that's kind of landlocked, and they're looking a way to get their product out, and so it's one that's being studied. So, but I'll agree with you on that. I'd like to see us do more with that railroad.
But the comparison with the tourism and the tourists that are paying such low ticket fares, you know, have you looked at any way to rectify that situation? Because our tourists are riding those ferries for next to nothing in comparison.
I'm going to have to let Louise speak to ferry rates. I have no idea what they are. I know when I've tried to ride a ferry out of here and get a price, I usually end up driving, so I have no idea. But
the ferries really aren't that inexpensive. They're truly not. That in the last been gone up, what I think 80%, and now they're increasing the rider fees based on the high volume. So the busier they are in the summer season, the more you're going to pay. That's how they've adjusted those rates. They've also adjusted the freight rates. About 3 years ago, I noticed that there was a lot of seafood companies using the ferries to ship their products out of Cordova, out of Kodiak, Unalaska. Which is fine, but we shouldn't, as a state, be subsidizing that freight rate. And subsequently, they have increased their freight rates as well. So we are no longer subsidizing them. So maybe at one time that might have been the case. That's simply not the case now.
And just to touch one more brief time on the ferry system, we up here, four of us, will acknowledge that we think it's probably been one of the worst managed pieces of property that we've had. We were not happy. It always been managed the conditions our ships are in today, and having said that, we think probably over time a lot more service has been provided to communities that didn't really need to have it twice a week or whatever the number is. So I can tell you Representative Stutes is working on a detailed plan for which boats go back in the water. Communities that used to get it once a week might get it once a month now, so really a lot less, really getting it streamlined. They're working out them details. Yes, sir.
Anyway, we used to live in Petersburg and Ketchikan, and the ferries are, I mean, people use them. In the summer, they're packed. In the winter, well, you can kind of roll around in there. You can hear the echo in the mouth. But it just seems like there'd be ways to seasonally somehow adjust that to where you're not pushing all that water with that big boat with not that many people in the boat to help pay for it. And the only other thing I would add is that currently a lot of the airports are federally subsidized. So it's like you've got one subsidy fighting against the other subsidy. A lot of people in Petersburg would jump on a jet and fly to Juneau for, and it would cost them maybe $160 maybe one way, and they'd be back in a half hour or that same day in the afternoon. But that is also subsidized. So if there was somehow to have more efficiencies than that, I just wanted to add that.
So I can't speak to the airports, but I think what you mentioned about the ferries is exactly what they're doing. They're trying to ramp up as there's a need and revenue generating and throttle it down when it's not. And that's part of what I was just talking about there. So,
yeah, just sort of to cap things off on the ferry, it's interesting as we do the deep dive into what's a cost-effective ferry system and what's essential and what maybe can be handed off to once or twice a week ferry schedule, or perhaps even in the smaller runs, maybe some private companies picking up the slack, is the fact that we're learning that the ferry system has economic impacts around the state in a much greater swath than we ever imagined. The Department of Transportation did a $250,000 study with Northern Economics out of Anchorage. And in my office, just about a couple weeks ago, we had the military brass in, and they were telling us how important the ferry system was to the military in Alaska. Because keep in mind, Alaska is the most transient state of all 50 states. And one of the reasons that we're so transient is because we've got military people coming and going quite regularly into our bases, and with the F-35s and Fairbanks and so forth. And quite fascinating for me to dig through that study and to find out how many ferry employees live around the state. And so the economic impacts of a ferry system, we all agree, has to be restructured and has to be more cost effective, has actually spread more widely around the state than I think any of us ever anticipated. And again, a lot of this, and kind of the primary reason we're here talking to you this afternoon, is built on the fact that we have to make tough decisions that require us to do deep dives into the ferry and the university and other areas of government that we just haven't had to do in the past because we weren't forced to do it. So.
Just add one real quick thing to that. Our Alaska Marine Highway System is the training area for the marine pilots that shuttle in and out all the cruise boats, all those. That is their training ground. When the Coast Guard brings up any new commander of any kind of large vessel, they have to get their Alaska Marine Highway hours in first and foremost before they can take over command of the vessel. We also have one of our vessels, which is an oil response vessel. So they have huge impacts besides just transporting people and goods.
I was just going to add, effectively, as of right now, the marine highway system's almost come to a grinding halt as we speak today. And last year, the governor wanted to cut, I believe it was about $68 million. It was around 70% or so of the marine highway system's funding, and ended up compromising with the Senate that we all agreed on, which was to cut $40 million from the marine highway system. So it's been a very, very substantial cut there. And so, I think that's something to keep in mind.
So we're kind of getting short on time. I'm going to ask Representative Edgman to wrap up this presentation. And then I forgot to mention to you, but I got two gentlemen in the back, Mr. Dwayne Bannock and Mr. Daniel Lynch, have asked for about 6 minutes to talk about this online sales tax issue that's going around the state and affecting municipalities that do collect the sales tax. So I've agreed to give them 10 minutes. here. So I'll ask Representative Edgemond, and then when they get wrapped up, they're going to take about 10 minutes, and then we're just going to mingle with you guys. We don't want you guys we just want to talk, and we're really here. We tried to talk to you just to give you a layout, what we look at, what the budget picture really looks like, but we really do want to hear your thoughts. You know, I mean, that's why we're here, to get some feedback. We're going into the budget. Just your thoughts on anything in general. So we just, when the two gentlemen wrap up, we're just going to hang out here for as long as we can before they head back to the airport. And
sound good? Okay, thank you, Gary. We got two more slides. Let me just get right to, this is probably the most complicated slide we have to show you. There's two themes that we want to sort of portray here. We want to somehow, this is our best stab at showing you what a spending cap might look like, as well as we want to show you, the current levels of the budget and the current amount that we have to spend, and the choices we have to make, again, between funding essential state services and a permanent fund dividend without dipping somewhere else into money to pay for things. So what we did is we got three scenarios here. This is with what's called a surplus dividend. If we just stay under the projected revenue cap that we were looking for this year, we would have somewhere around a $700 dividend. If we pay a $1,600 PFD, as we have done the last 2 years, we're going to have to dip into revenue for what, Neil, $600 million or so. And if you pay for a $3,000 PFD, you're going to have to go way above that and look at easily over, what, $1.5 billion? About $1.5 billion. And I guess to be completely fair, we put all our cards on the table in terms of having a candid conversation with you. The governor's proposed back paying for 2019, $815 million, which would essentially bring that up even higher. And that's money that needs to come from somewhere. So that's one element of this slide. The other element is to again show you what the current budget probably is going to be, $4.51 billion. Under our revenue structure, we're looking at about $5.1 billion coming in. So if we were to, hypothetically, this is just sort of an illustration purposes, because there's talks ongoing in Juneau about a spending cap. They haven't happened in our committees yet. They're going to happen at some point. But if we were to just, in theory, cap off what we're going to spend by the amount of revenue that we have this year, that's what it would look like. Again, with the competition with everything that we fund in terms of state services, along with three different scenarios for a permanent fund dividend. And the hope is that this sort of kind of an all-in-one slide ties in what we're wrestling with down in Juneau, which is, in one hand, you know, we got the luxury of $5.1 billion. I'm sure if I asked how many of you around in the early 90s when we had $8 or $9 barrel oil, I was one of them down in Juneau working as a legislative staffer. We didn't have the money to even get to this level right here. So we had to make do without a lot and make a lot of budget reductions and so forth. So we have the luxury of having a lot of revenue. We're the envy of a lot of other states because we have a permanent fund that we hope to grow into the future and to continue to play a substantial role in funding all of this. And we also have pretty decent prospects up in the North Slope. We've got a tourism industry. We've got a military presence in the state. We've got a lot of good things going for Alaska. But in the meanwhile, we as policymakers have to, and hopefully with your input and help, make the decisions on how do we pay for all of this and where does the money come from.
That's a comment. The most obvious thing that this slide shows is that the only variable in all of this is the permanent fund dividend. You don't see any variables in any of the other graphs go straight across. Those all maintain. So my question is this, gentlemen and ma'am. If you are running your own household, do you not find a way to cut expenses in every category? Or do you just take out your children's permanent or your children's college fund and say, wham, sorry, you're not going to college anymore? What is the actual responsibility that you have? You know your revenues, you know your budgets, but you want to exceed it all the time, and you're pointing to the permanent fund as being the only reason why that budget is overdrawn.
Well, I would beg to differ with you. This is an illustration. This is not a set in stone what we're here to advocate to you about. Well, I tried to be clear a moment ago that we can't cut education too much without facing court challenges that would require us to basically put the money back in. The Constitution, we can't go against the Constitution. That's also largely constitutionally mandated as well. Department of Corrections, what do? We let people, criminals out on the street? We can't do that. University of Alaska, we need to continue to grow the state in some way. Public safety, we need more troopers. We need more presence in our communities. Capital budget, way too small there. That should be bigger. There are people on the other end of the spectrum. And again, I'm not here to advocate. I'm just trying to present to you the mindset of what's happening in Juneau. There are other people who would tell you that, you know, it's not a spending problem as much as it might be a revenue problem, because we're the one state in the entire country that doesn't have a broad-based revenue measure. The one state. And I'd love to keep it that way. And I know Representative Knopp would love to keep it that way. These are the choices in front of us, though. They're difficult choices. And we're not here to say, this is the right one, that's the right one, this is the right one. This is all under consideration in Juneau.
And that is your generator revenue now, is to cut that. That's how you generate your revenue without representation. You're making that decision, but changing it from years old and tested, that maintained a permanent fund throughout time, let it grow, and you've changed the percentages to the point where that you now take from the people without representation.
And you are correct. And so what you're saying is you could reorder this, for example, and put the permanent fund down here and then everything up there. And that can absolutely be done. And I think that's part of the reason why, like, for example, the Finance Committee last year is trying to get out to all the different communities. I would note, and again, just what I mentioned earlier, you know, back in FY13, our budget was $7.8 billion. Last year, that budget was $4.3 billion. That's a, $4.3 billion. So that's a $3.5 billion cut. We cut it over that time period by about 45%. And believe me, I am on board with trying to continue to keep this spending curve down, continue to bend that down. We've got members in our group who absolutely want to add to everything. And with Gary's help, I mean, I'm on board with Gary, and I'm telling everybody, you guys, we got to stop spending. We can't add. It's going to be a little bit of everything, and we got to stop that. And so we've got that issue of trying to hold those folks back. And I guess as Bryce had mentioned, you know, there are three things in the Constitution. Two of them are kind of very broad. That is, we must provide for public health, public welfare, and then education. So education is kind of a hard one to cut. But I guess just to say two points, the first one being that right now the governor would like to pay the full dividend, which is $3,100. And to do that, that creates about a $1.5 billion deficit. And all of these small things down here, they're so small that you would literally have to cut, of the 18 agencies that are in the state, you would have to totally eliminate commerce, military and veterans affairs, labor, revenue, fish and game, law, natural resources, judiciary, corrections, public safety, and that's getting rid of every, you know, trooper vehicle and every trooper, and just in that, I'm not saying let's do that, but what I'm saying is that number is such a big number that you literally have to just get rid of everything, and the only two things that would be left would be K-12 education. You're getting rid of the entire university in that scenario. You would have K-12 education and then health and social services. And so it's definitely a big big issue. We do need to continue, but you're right, to push that number down. But my last point is the governor just came out with his final numbers here in the last few days. And his budget, last year, by the way, the House, we cut $200 million from the budget last year. And that's something that we feel we need to continue to do. The governor just came out with his final budget a few days ago, and he's up over last year's budget by about $250 million. part of its formula, part of it he has no control over. For example, healthcare costs keep going up. There's a formula that that pays for education. He has no control over that. But there are some things that he had to add back. For example, he thought he could save $120 million with Medicaid, and the feds came back and said, you know, you can't do these things that you want to do, so he had to add that money back. So there's a lot of challenges, but I just wanted to underscore that you are right. We need to continue to do that. A lot of the easy cuts are gone, and trying to get these, you know, these cuts are getting harder and harder to get each year. So
I know Bryce is going to get to this last slide. Can I just ask you to move forward there real quick? So this is where we started out, and the point I'm trying to make, when you went from the black to the red, that's when we lost all of our revenue, spent our savings down the last 4 years, completely out of savings. One of the things Neil just said, we adamantly don't think any broad-based revenue. We're trying to avoid the income tax, the sales tax. We think with fiscal discipline, we can build that big blue bubble to $85 to $100 million, continue to draw that interest, and not have the need for that revenue. So we're really fighting not to impose an income tax or a statewide sales tax. That's our biggest battle. If the populace wanted to go there, our job would be pretty easy and be done. But it's not what we're trying to do. And so to your point, what I kept saying, we're out of savings. We're at the minimums for state revenue to pay out a full PFD at this point under the old statutory formula. And that's the rock and the hard spot we're up against. As Neil just pointed out, you'd wipe out about 15 agencies, completely wipe them out. All the court system, troopers, everything that we're used to, DOT, you name it, would be go away in order to pay that dividend when you're out of savings. So that's the point we're trying to make here. And we got some questions. I'm going to turn it to Bryce, let it finish, and I'll get Penny and Dave to hold their question. We'll get to you here in just a minute, please.
Yeah, I think we're done. So if we can go to questions, Penny, maybe start with you.
I just had a couple of really quick comments. I think we need to continue with some of the services we have in order to continue to build our state and to maintain a population. We have to provide services that will keep young people here, like a quality education, not just K-12, but at the college. If we privatize that education at the college, it will cost a lot, and many students can't afford that. So it'll be really important to keep them here. Also, I think that we should look at several sources of revenue, and I think we should keep the PFD at a sustainable level and not a going out of business level. We want people to know and think that Alaska is still in business. We are a strong state. We are a good people, and we care about our community, and we care about providing quality services that will enhance their way of life. So that's all I want to say. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Could we go back one slide? And I want to reference that because you got on the far left the sustainable PFD, and then on the far right you got the inflated ones that put us into the deficit. Has Neil or anybody figured out on those two right columns how much of would actually end up in the pocket of the PFD recipient? Because with those, and I've seen it already in the fishing business, I've had fees increase 150% to 200% already. And we're talking about taxes going up, local, borough, whatever, to make up the difference of, say, you got $3,000 compared to $1,000. How much of that $3,000 would be left? You're going to be paying federal taxes on it. And a lot of these fees, once they increase, they're not going to come down. So even when we get to a sustainable level, you're going to have these inflated fees and goals or taxes and all that. Has any of that stuff been figured in yet? Because it's kind of deceptive to the people. You know, you get $3,000, but if you're paying $1,500 in taxes and increased fees and everything else, and they're going to continue, you're actually losing money on the deal. Thanks.
So I want to jump in because I think you raised two very important points. One is that cutting the state budget is basically cost shifting to local governments. We see that with the school bond debt reimbursement program, which was $70 million or so transferred to local boroughs and municipalities around the state this year. We'll see whether or not that amount gets vetoed down or what the legislature and the governor does beyond that. You know, it's interesting in terms of the permanent fund dividend. I'll go out on a limb here and basically say that I don't think there's ever been a comprehensive economic study done on the impacts of the permanent fund across the state. We all know it has positive economic benefits, but if you take in totality the fact that about 6 or 7% of that permanent fund gets garnished by the Department of Corrections and by other institutions along the way, X amount of that dividend goes into college savings plans. A lot of the dividend goes to outside corporations for trips to Hawaii or whatever it might be, which is you know, the prerogative of individual recipients for sure. So how much of the money actually stays in the state and circulates around after you take out federal taxes and whatnot? I don't think there's ever been a comprehensive study, you know, sort of in the same vein that we're looking at the Marine Highway system, you know, really digging down below the surface and looking at the true benefit of all. Again, as legislators, we're looking at making the numbers kind of work for the long term and providing a balance. And I think along the way, that analysis is probably going to take place. I think I would add as well, Dave, that there's also the social aspect of paying a big PFD. I know in the district I represent, there's people that don't use that permanent fund dividend for the right things. I'm not saying that that's a big margin, but I know there are people out there who don't, you know, use it to buy fuel oil or food or what have you. But I'm going to step off the gangplank right there because it's a controversial subject. The PFD is vital. We're going to do everything we can to keep it in place, but we also want to keep education and everything else funded too.